You're listening to The Wing Women, a podcast brought to you by journalists and best mates, Frankie Gradden, that's her, and Charlie Gowans Edmonton, that's me. Franks, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Charles. Just sipping on this coffee. By the way, happy National Coffee Day.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
We're recording on Wednesday.
It is the crack o' dawn again.
Yeah, early doors, but this is a delicious coffee, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah. Could have done with a few more Z's, but, you know, nothing doing. What have you been up to?
Well, you know what I've been up to.
I was there.
Because you were there, we went to our first wedding of the year and of the pandemic era.
Very exciting.
So this was our very, very good friend Sarah, who, bless her cottons, was meant to be getting married in June. It was a big affair, 150. Got scaled down to October the 2nd. And then when the news came out about the rule of 15, they managed to pull it forward to Sunday.
She'd already had to rejig as well. Mid-summer, they announced that you had to be in a COVID-secure venue. So she'd already had to scramble and find a reception because she was supposed to be having it in her parents' garden. Yes. In a marquee.
So all the plans had gone out the window, but they pulled it off. And wasn't it just lovely?
It was glorious.
I think weddings are always very emotional. I always get incredibly emotional at weddings, apart from my own, weirdly.
Yeah. But we both cried at Sarah's.
It was beautiful. And I think that in this era where so many people's wedding plans and other plans are having to be cancelled, it feels all the more emotional and all the more poignant that they managed to do it and have a gorgeous time. And it was a lovely time. There were 30. It still felt very full. I put some pictures up on Instagram of it, and lots of people were asking me whether it felt odd that we were in masks. And actually, I didn't think it felt that weird. I kind of forgot about it.
I feel like we've adjusted to the mask now.
Very much so. So she got married in a church, and you have to wear masks when you're in the church. But lots of people had done some glam masks. Our friend Sam had made her own, which is fabulous.
If you've got a glue gun, the world's your fucking oyster, isn't it?
It really is.
That was glorious, her mask.
And
the bride and groom didn't have to.
No, the bride and groom thankfully didn't have to, and the vicar didn't have to. But it did feel really quite normal and really lovely.
It was just nice to have something really happy to celebrate. Mm. I think because we've postponed so many of the big joyful things, like weddings, like my sister's wedding, which should have been a couple of weeks ago, you then don't have that many things to look forward to. And I think because we're in this post-planning era, as you called it last week, it does mean that people aren't wanting to book in weddings, aren't wanting to book in big holidays, you're not planning weekends away. So normally, when it starts to get a bit cold and grey out, you've got things to look forward to. And you can think, oh, but I've got that weekend coming up with friends, or that wedding, which is going to be amazing. So I hadn't realised how much I was missing that. Just an excuse to dress up and have a lovely meal and drink delicious wine and have a bit of a socially distanced dance, even.
It was lovely. The dressing up thing was amazing. This is the first time I put on heels since probably February, actually. And it felt so good to drag out some clothes from the wardrobe that I just thought, well, this year they're not going to see any form of daylight, and pop them on my body. And it was just lovely.
It was glorious. 10 out of 10 would recommend, guys.
Would recommend.
Go to those 15-person weddings.
I think there's something really nice about a small, intimate gathering.
Well, it harks back to early days lockdown, when they first announced bubbles and that we were going to be allowed to see people in a bubble. And I wrote about MySpace top friends. This is that, isn't it?
It is.
When you're choosing your top 30, top 15, even tighter. If you're choosing a 6.
Oof. Well, congratulations, Sarah and Andrew.
I thought you were going to go congratulate us on being in the top friends.
Well, and congratulations to us for making the cut.
Congratulations, Deegs.
What have you been up to?
Well, kind of that.
Great.
Yeah.
Same.
I mean, that'll work.
Oh my God, though. Can I tell you about... So, we're buying some bathroom stuff because we're doing the bathroom. Our bathroom. Not just the bathroom. Specifically ours.
What's the bathroom?
I don't know. Like, the world's bathroom.
Right.
It was weird how I'd phrased it. Our bathroom. Ben has a strange notion that he wants a stand-up toilet roll holder rather than a wall-mounted one, which I think is madness.
If he's standing, he doesn't need it, does he?
So the toilet holder is a stand-up.
Right. But is it so that you can reach it if you're not sitting down? Is that why it's designed?
I don't know. I think he's more upset about having to twist around to the wall behind him and get the toilet roll from there.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
That motion is troubling him.
Would you put in just a classic on the wall hook thing?
Yeah, but the wall is behind the loo.
Right.
So there's no side walls.
I see.
Sorry.
And Ben just lacks that agility in his spine.
He just doesn't want to do that. So he's been looking for some stand-up toilet roll holders. Even though when you live in a small space, floor space is of a premium and we don't want to be wasting it. But anyway, so I've been looking at toilet roll holders. That was a long, convoluted way of saying I've been looking at some toilet roll holders.
It was just enough detail. I could have had more, actually.
And I came across, I'm going to find the retailer, because I am going to name and shame, Tap Warehouse. It is a toilet...
If you're listening, Tap Warehouse, which no doubt you are.
How dare you? It is a toilet roll holder that is also a phone holder. I'm going to show you the picture. So it's a classic wall-mounted toilet roll holder with a platform for you to pop your phone on top.
No.
Isn't that awful?
That is awful. What is wrong with the world?
So many things. Considering my conversation last week about the social dilemma, which I've been asking everybody if they've seen, and immediately instructing them to, if they haven't yet, and all about the dangers of being addicted to our telephones, I thought that this was just the next level.
What about if you suspended the toilet paper from the ceiling?
Oh yeah, that would be nice.
Sort of like an little installation. Mobile. Exactly.
Toilet roll mobile.
Great for kids as well. Pip would love it.
Yeah.
Actually, if he's ever struggling to sleep, you could just pop him on the toilet lid. So obviously put the seat down.
Obviously.
For safety. And then just give him a bit of a swoosh round and he could just watch the toilet rolls fly.
Lovely. Well, I'll keep you updated on which bog roll holder we go for.
Please do. And Tap Warehouse, we expect a full apology in the post.
What would you like to talk about this week, Chazzy?
Well, I read a piece on The Guardian called Dreading a Dark Winter Lockdown, Think Like a Norwegian by David Robson. I am dreading a dark winter lockdown only because obviously in winter when you don't have sunlight, everything can feel a little bit more depressing. This is cosy snuggle weather, so it's not a great time to be isolated in your house. My house gets very cold. My heating bill, as we've discussed, would be astronomical. I've been dreading it a little bit because also this is my favourite time of year and I'm worried it's not going to be the same. However, David Robson talks about a study that health psychologist Carrie Leibowitz carried out. She is American and she visited the Norwegian city of Tromsø. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but I liked saying it. Which, for 2 months in the depths of winter, doesn't have sunrise and sunset in a traditional way. So they are completely starved of sunlight. But the inhabitants of Tromsø said it again. Said it a bit differently this time. Roll my R a little bit more. Please write in, Norwegians. Tell me what I'm doing wrong. Don't experience seasonal affective disorder. They don't experience winter depression. So you would think that they would. Because I certainly feel a change in my mood in winter when I'm not getting enough sun. If I'm leaving the house in the darkness, coming back in the darkness, and spending the whole day in an office, I feel the difference. But these Norwegians don't. Clever Norwegians.
What's their secret?
It is a positive mindset.
Oh, that old chestnut.
Right. So it's to do with mindset and, quote, mental framing of stressful events. Well, here's a stressful event. How are we going to mentally frame it? So I thought, let's get excited about winter. What are the bits you're looking forward to?
Okay. Good telly.
Oh, great one.
The telly has really picked up,
mm-hmm.
which I'm pleased about, because I thought the summer's telly was absolutely shocking.
Shocking telly. What have you been liking?
Oh, I've been watching Ratchet on Netflix and enjoying it, but I'm also terrified of it. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it through the whole series.
Very scary.
It is quite scary, but Sarah Paulson is so good.
She's phenomenal.
And the outfits. It's set in the 1940s, if anyone hasn't watched it or read about it. And the costumes are kind of this exaggerated version of 40s dressing. Incredibly glamorous. It's almost errs on the Wes Anderson, doesn't it? The colours are so saturated and poppy, and kind of there's that surrealist element to it.
And the way it looks is so stylized. The symmetry of each shot, each still could be a picture. It's just gorgeous.
It's lovely.
It's a prequel to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, if anyone's wondering.
So there is some gore, just to flag. It's rated an 18.
But it's spooky season.
It is spooky season. Halloween's coming up. Another thing to be excited about.
Do you do anything at Halloween, though?
Carve pumpkins.
Do you? Lovely.
Yeah. Funny, I didn't do it as a child. Halloween wasn't really a thing when we were kids. The American influence hadn't come over. So we certainly didn't do trick-or-treating. And obviously I'm too old now. Sad. I'd love some sweets. But we do carve a pumpkin. I'm shit at it. But it's quite fun doing it.
Lovely.
So that's another reason to be cheerful.
Do you make soup with the innards?
I have made pumpkin soup.
Lovely.
That's another one. Here we go. We're on a roll.
Soup.
Soup season is brilliant.
I love soup.
And actually, I haven't made it yet, so I can't tell you if it's any good, but it's Anna Jones, so it will be good.
Always.
On her website, she's got a section on autumn recipes, and she's got a soup that you can eat three ways.
As in, through your mouth.
Standing on your head. Back to front. You can eat it as is, add some cannellini beans and a crunchy topping, and you bolt it up for a bit more of a robust meal. Then on the third go, she pours hers, interesting, over some rice.
Ooh.
And add something else to it, and I just can't remember what it is. But it sounds delicious. And you just batch cook this pretty simple soup. If you've got a freezer, go for it. Keep it going all winter.
Yum.
What are you looking forward to?
Hot wine, by which I mean mulled wine.
Yeah.
But I love that when we get to the time of year where it's a bit cold for just wine, we just make hot wine.
I love hot wine. There's always a workaround for something, isn't there?
Mince pies. Very excited about mince pies. That weather, which I think we're already coming into, where it starts to feel really crisp, and when you're walking home in the evening, because I've been walking from the office quite often, and normal lights start to look twinkly and festive. Mm. So these aren't fairy lights, but you'll just see somebody's light over their door and it suddenly looks twinkly and festive. And I know it's just a security light, but I'm like, lovely.
Into Wonderland.
Knitwear. Very excited about knitwear.
Both sat here in our roll necks.
Love.
Do you say roll necks, polo necks or turtlenecks?
I normally say roll necks.
Mm.
They are all different, aren't they? But
I find it very confusing.
Yours is technically a roll because it's rolled over.
It has rolled over.
This hasn't rolled.
Is it a turtle?
I think it's a turtle.
You look like a turtle.
Do I?
Yeah.
Well, that's very exciting.
Well, and what a jolly spin on what could be a bit of a sad time.
Well, I think we're all worried about it, but he is right. The more you worry about something, the worse it is. And I always, certainly in the rest of my life, try not to go down rabbit holes of worrying about things, because you often imagine things worse than they actually turn out, and you go to the worst case scenario. We don't know yet how severe lockdown is going to be if we have a second lockdown. We don't know how long it's going to last. And yes, that is all really stressful, but positive mindset. How very Californian of us.
How very Californian.
Anyway, what would you like to talk about this week?
So I've read a great piece on The Cut by Katie Heaney, and it's called Are All My Friends Mad at Me?
Ooh.
Mm. It's actually really funny, but it's very interesting, and I think speaks to certainly me. I think it's going to speak to you. I think it's going to speak to a lot of us. But the piece talks about friendship paranoia and how that has been cultivated during the pandemic. So she talks about the fact that she hasn't been able to see a lot of her friends and they've just been communicating over text, how that's created a bit of a distance and also made it easier to worry as to whether or not people are angry at you. We've all received a text message that we've read into and thought, that tone seems off. And it's incredibly hard over text message to convey a tone. It probably was just an off-the-cuff, yeah, great, or sure, no problem. But I think when you're feeling a bit fragile anyway, as a lot of us are in the pandemic, you tend to read into things that maybe aren't there. So she's sort of poor woman going around thinking all of her friends are livid at her because she hasn't been able to see them face-to-face and to have that time when you connect and you have a deep, long chat over dinner or a glass of wine or a walk, etc. So she speaks to a few psychologists and one of them mentions that friendship is actually completely dependent on routine. And obviously we haven't had that. It's been all up in the air. And as a result, some of our friendships have suffered. Katie talks about the C tier friendships.
Ooh.
I know. Imagine being a C-tier friendship. But we do all have, you know, you have your close, best bosom pals who you see regularly. And then you have the people that maybe you don't see so regularly. She talks about work friends, gym buddies, those people who you love and you see in normal life regularly because it's worked into your routine. But because no one's going to the office, no one's going to the gym, we aren't seeing them. And how easy it is for those friendships to suffer and to potentially drift away, which I thought was very interesting. Playing into all of this, she also talks about extra tensions being created through friendships. I mean, this pandemic has really highlighted the differences in people's life circumstances. So she mentions if some friends are employed and others aren't, if your friend is in a relationship and you aren't, if a friend is able to see parents and you aren't, how that can cause friction within friendships, whereas before you wouldn't have even really given it a second thought.
I do think there's something in that. For me, not so much about employment or money. I've been very lucky to still be working, but what I have been aware of is the different levels of caution that friends are taking. So I'm not seeing my parents regularly at the moment because I'm back in an office and I am worried that actually the office is very secure, but I'm just worried about taking public transport. So I'm now walking to work or driving. I'm trying to do that so that I can see my parents in good conscience because I just couldn't risk it otherwise. And I feel the same way about seeing my friend with a newborn baby, about seeing you, that I need to be very careful. Every decision that I make and every decision that all of us make is risk assessment at the moment. And I appreciate that actually, if you are in a different position to me, if your family don't live nearby, so you don't have any relatives who are perhaps more at risk living nearby, if you don't have friends who are in high risk categories, I can see why perhaps there isn't that motivation for you to be extra careful. And so I have felt that with friends who are going spinning, and one of my colleagues has been going out a lot more socially. They're not breaking the rules. There's nothing wrong with that. It's personal choice. But I have felt that friction that you then start to worry because if you're seeing that person, you're almost taking all the risks they've taken. And I think that is a sticking point.
Well, in the piece, Katie speaks to Professor of Psychology Marzad Hojat, and they say the time is ripe for friendship fights exactly because of that reason. And they point out that, I mean, this is an American piece and they're saying the government guidelines are unclear, but I mean, it's the same over here. I think it's just the same worldwide. It's a very difficult situation to advise for. And so the advice is slightly confused and open to interpretation. So people are treating it in very different ways. And so we are getting this situation where one person in a friendship group might be doing one thing, someone else is doing another thing, and of course that's going to be incredibly difficult because we're all viewing this in different ways and with different severity, I guess. But I've definitely found, coming back to the tier, I don't tend to tier my friendships, and I would never call a friend a C-list friend.
What tier am I on then?
But I've definitely found, you know, you have those friends who you see twice a month for dinner and it's amazing and it's like you've never been apart and you pick up just where you've left off and you chat all night, and then you know, even though you say when you leave, we have to do this more often, you know you won't, you'll see them in another 2 months and you'll have a great night together. And that's a lovely friendship, that's a really joyful friendship. But those friendships I haven't been able to maintain because we haven't been going out for dinner every 2 months. And I've been so sad about not losing them, of course not, but them diminishing slightly, not having that catch up in regular intervals, so that when we do catch up, it's going to be like, well, how was your year? And that feels really sad. And I think also geographically, friends who live far away, whether that's the other side of the city or whether it's outside of the city in different locations, because travel has been so difficult and continues to be so difficult, not being able to see them is hard. In the piece, Katie says, well, we should just pick up the phone. But of course we never do, because we are so unused to actually making phone calls now that you just text or, you know, you just send a quick message. So maybe we need to get back on the phones.
I think it's realising how important those friendships are, even if they're not your primary relationships. And we get different things out of different friendships. And we can't get everything that we need from one person. I mean, you possibly can, because it's me. But it's the same, we've talked about this, that in relationships, actually, when you first start dating someone, you start to get serious, and you kind of think you should get everything from them. And then the realisation that you can still continue to see friends, and there's nothing wrong with needing other things that your partner doesn't give you, because it's a different relationship. That's your primary relationship, and then you have your secondary relationships of your closest friends, or maybe for some people those are primary relationships, I don't know. I've never tiered them. But you might have a friend who you only see once every couple of months, but she's the friend that you get into really deep conversations with about X, Y, and Z. Or she's the person that you can really speak openly with about money or your sex life or stress that you're having with your family. Even though she's not the person you speak to every day, she's not the person you have coffee with three times a week and go for walks with, that relationship is important. And to lose those temporarily, yes, but to lose those for 6 months, 8 months, a year can be really damaging. I think especially now when we're kind of all reflecting on our lives so much, and you maybe have more to talk about and more that you want to hash out with people. And if you're suddenly lacking those friendships, I think that's really difficult.
Well, the ironic thing in all of this is that never more so have we needed our friends around us for support. We all need so much more support than usual because it's a really stressful time. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, potench. So in the piece, Professor Hojat says that this experience could be better in the long run for our friendships, because after this pandemic ends, if it ever ends, but when we get to a place where we can comfortably live with it, they make the point that after all this time of just messaging and having relationships virtually or through technology, we will most likely go back to a place where we are seeing people face to face, and therefore, I guess, spending more quality time with people, which I'm looking forward to.
Me too. You can definitely still have social anxiety when you see people face to face, because I am a real one for going to a party or a dinner party, seeing some friends for a weekend and having the loveliest time, just the loveliest time, had a great time, smiling and laughing the whole time, come home by myself. Was I awful? Oh my God, I spoke too much. That was a weird joke. Shouldn't have said that. I didn't read these cues from that person. I can, within half an hour, have convinced myself that I was the worst person in the world. Sometimes I am the worst person in the world, but sometimes I'm not, and I would have convinced myself of it anyway, and I can completely reinterpret the whole situation that I was just in from the point of view of I'm the worst and nobody likes me and all my friends are mad at me. So I have been known to just text and be like, was I awful?
Well, your friendship paranoia must be off the scale then right now.
No, mine's actually better, because I can't have said anything that bad or been awful because I'm not in person. So I only worry that people are mad at me because I'm a dick. If I haven't had the opportunity to be a dick, it really diminishes. So I'm never particularly great at staying in contact. I've never been good at texting. I show up when you need me, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not good at that texting. How did that meeting go? Like, little things, or just, how are you in a text conversation? That's not for me. I am more of an in-person person. So I definitely have had way less contact with a lot of my friends. But for me, I think how often I see someone has never been a reflection of how much I love them. So I kind of feel like my friendships were already prepared for this time, because I do occasionally fall off the grid a bit and just disappear because I get a bit overwhelmed with work or a bit tunnel vision about something. So I really have that tendency. So I think people were prepared for me to disappear.
Your friendships are already pandemic proof.
No chance here. It's just happening to everyone else. I can give you tips, guys. Get in touch. Anyway, what would you like to recommend to me this week, Renu?
I want to recommend a 2-part documentary on Channel 4 called Write-Offs, hosted by Sandy Totsvig. Lovely to see her again.
Sandy, missed you.
She's fab, isn't she? So this documentary follows a group of people who cannot read or write. And they are taught how to do it over, I think it's a 4-month period.
And these people, how have they found them? What kind of ages are they?
Complete mixed bag. All adults. I think the youngest is early 20s, ranging right up to Tommy, who is in his mid-60s. So these are people who have built families, have built jobs, living their life in a relatively normal way, except for the fact that they cannot read or write, which has had a massive impact on how they can function.
And actually, that's a testament to these people, that they have managed to, you know, have careers and families, because how would you even begin?
Well, throughout the programme, you see the hurdles that they have to come up against. So things like shopping, writing a shopping list, can't write a shopping list. If someone writes them a shopping list, can't read it. If they're there looking at the spice rack in Tesco's, trying to work out what's parsley and what's coriander, can't. One of the youngest participants, she's a mum, she's actually pregnant throughout the series as well. She can't travel because map reading is difficult or train times are difficult. It's huge. And what's so sad is that something happened in school for the majority of them. There's one guy actually who was an English teacher and had a stroke and lost the ability to read and write. So his story is slightly different, but for the majority of them in school, it was just never picked up, or it was picked up, but they didn't know how to deal with it. And the education system wasn't as such that it could recognise that a brain was working in a different way. And so teaching had to be adapted to help them learn what other kids could pick up so quickly. I found it so moving. Bit of a spoiler alert, but they do a spelling bee at the end and you see the improvement. And that's just in 4 months with specialist support and education. They all come on leaps and bounds and it's amazing, but also so sad that they've had to live so much of their lives with these hurdles and with so much fear around reading and writing, and it wasn't able to be sorted earlier. But it's just so incredibly moving to see this process. And I guess it resonated with me particularly. I mean, I was in floods of tears by the second series. Part of that will be pregnancy hormones. I cry at the drop of a hat. But I can read and write. I'm a writer. It's my job. But I've always struggled.
That would be a plot twist.
It would be. Imagine if I just dictated to you and you just sat and wrote it all up for me. Thanks, babe. But I really struggle with spelling, and it's something I've always struggled with. I think what really got to me was these people saying how stupid they felt and how stupid they were made to feel, especially at a young age in school when they didn't pick things up as quickly as their classmates. And that's how I felt. I've been terrible at spelling from an early age, and there was definitely that sense that I was a bit thick because I couldn't get it. There was a spelling test when I was in year 6 and I scored so badly on the test, they thought the machine marking the test had broken. So they made me redo it at the front of the class with the teacher, and I scored even worse.
Oh my God.
I did so badly.
Awful.
Well, this isn't a dig on teachers at all, because God, teaching is hard and I don't even know the half of it. But it stays with you. And I think when you don't pick something up that is supposed to just be second nature, when your brain needs a bit more time or a different way of approaching things, I think you can be made to feel really thick. And it is so embarrassing. At 32, there are tons of words I can't spell. And I have to ask people, or I Google them mainly, or I spell them wrong. And Charlie has to change the newsletter every week because I've put an errant letter in or just completely got the thing wrong and I just can't see it. That element of it really hit home, and it just made me think, God, you know, brains are so complex and so different, and we shouldn't judge people because people do things in a completely different way. And just because you can't read and write or spell doesn't mean you're thick at all.
Not in the slightest. But I didn't know that this was even something on your radar, spelling, because you've made jokes about it before, and I do often spell check the newsletter, but I didn't know it was something you were self-conscious of, because we're all just better at some things than others. And yes, I check the spelling on the newsletter, but you do other things that I'm less good at. And that's just how we all are, isn't it? That we have our strengths and then other things that are harder work for us. And I have those too. And so I didn't realise that it's something you were self-conscious of, because of course you shouldn't be.
Thanks, babe.
Has this made you feel self-conscious when you've started a new job or...?
Totally. And like filling out forms, if someone's watching me fill out a form and I don't know how to spell something, I'll just write really messily so that people can't see it. Weirdly, the pressure of writing a card, a birthday card or a Christmas card or a congratulations card, I have to write the message first, check my spelling is right, and then put it into the card. Because the pressure just makes my brain completely seize
up. But I always fuck up on a card as well.
The what same. Is that?
Like their name or something.
Obviously now we live in the era of spell check. So that makes life a lot easier. But look, it's not like prohibitive. And I'm by no means saying I'm on the scale of these guys who are in this series. But it is something that, you know, I get self-conscious over. And I just think I've never watched anything where illiteracy has been highlighted in that way and positioned as something that can be quite normal and can really affect people. So I found it very refreshing to watch it and have it discussed in that way.
Had these people kept it a secret from families?
A lot of people have. And they just had workarounds. So one guy had an app on his phone that he would say what he wanted into it, and then it would spell it out for him, and that's how he'd do it. Or Google Maps, you know, there's the voice that tells you the direction, so you don't have to read a map or a board of directions. So yes, they just adapted their lives. But it's well worth it. It's incredibly interesting. These people are so brave to go on national television and say that they can't read and write. It's so mood boosting, actually, to see how far they come, and Sandy is a dream.
I can't wait to watch it.
Chaz, what's your recommendation this week?
Mine is... Oh, side note, I watched Enola Holmes.
Oh!
On Netflix.
That's something else I'm looking forward to.
It's really good. It's Millie Bobby Brown and Helena Bonham Carter.
Heaven.
It's a period romp. I enjoyed it very much. That's all I'm going to say about it, because you should just watch it. It's great fun. It's a Sherlock Holmes spin-off thing, so it's self-explanatory. But I found a new podcast.
Ooh,
so lovely. As I said, I have been walking home a lot from the office, which is 77 minutes at a brisk pace. But that is sticking to main roads, which I don't really like to do because it's not very fun. So actually, it takes me like 2 hours to walk home. But it's a lovely walk. So I've been listening to a podcast called Home Cooking with Samin Nosrat and Hrishikesh Herwe. And Samin is a chef and the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is a recipe book you might have heard of.
I think I have.
And Hrishikesh hosts podcasts and is a creator. Basically, it's a recipe podcast. So people write in. I listened to one that was called Getting Jalapeno Business.
Love it. Fantastic.
Just because I really liked the name of that episode. So I didn't start at the first episode. I started with that one. So people had written in to say that they had gotten loads of jalapenos in a veg delivery and they didn't know what to do with them and what would they recommend. And the co-hosts suggest recipes and talk about where they've gotten these recipes from, what they liked about them, how you could amend them at home. So it's very useful, but it's funny. They're obviously very good friends and they take the piss out of each other. And she is a chef and he is not a chef. So she will tease him about certain things. It's American. I found it really warm and comforting. I will probably never buy a rice cooker, but I enjoyed hearing about different types of rice cooker. And they had a guest on who had been cooking rice in 4 different ways to see which was the best method. It made me hungry, which is a good thing. It would be nice company if you're cooking and you want someone to talk to you. But I think I have definitely run out of food ideas because I'm cooking at home so much and so much more than I did pre-lockdown. And in the beginning, I was very adventurous and now I've settled into a rut. So if you have banana bread ennui, if you are roasting a chicken every Saturday, a la me, and that's your one big cooking for the week and the rest of the time you're just eating salads, listen to this podcast. It's great.
I will listen to that. I need some inspo.
It's so jolly. It really cheered me up. So by the time I got home, I was just in a really good mood.
And ravenous.
Absolutely starving. And livid that I couldn't have any jalapeno poppers.
Oh, yum.
Yum.
Well, thank you. I will listen to that because I do need a new podcast. On that note, let's wrap it up. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you've heard, please do rate and review, subscribe, and tell your pals.
God, do it all.
Whole shebang.
You could even drop us an email at thewingwomanofficial@gmail.com. Oh. Do you like how we put in official to make it sound official, even though it's a gmail.com?
We're professionals. You can also hear more from us via our Sunday newsletter. You can subscribe at thewingwoman.co.uk.
And you can find us on Instagram at Frankie Gravin, at Charlie Gowans, and collectively at thewingwoman_.
Until next week.
Bye!